be away. So let me see where we were up to. I think we were somewhere just at the beginning of the question of the freedom of the press. We were moving on to the question of freedom of the press. Now, obviously, the freedom of the press is something which we consider to be quite important, and it normally enters into the definition of democracy. But as we'll see, people were talking about the freedom of the press a long time before democracy arrived. Press freedom is never total. And this is probably fortunate because if I wanted to write, everybody should murder Master Alcinoumont's students, then quite rightly it is illegal for me to put this on the front page of a newspaper. So freedom of press is not absolute, but nevertheless it's generally accepted that in a democracy you need to have a reasonable possibility of criticising the powers that be. Now, this is useful, obviously, for the masses, in the sense that they are in need of some way of making sure that it's possible to advance their interests. So, of course, when we think about Eastern European dictatorships, which have disappeared, and some of the dictatorships in North Africa which have fallen, one of the things we think of is, oh yes, the freedom of the press, then ordinary people can put forward their interests. But it's also often necessary for the elite, because the elite is not homogenous, and so if the government wants to know what's happening in the country, then they often find that they need to, if there's somebody knocking on the door, can you deal with that? Yeah. They often find that they need a certain freedom of the press. We saw in Russia at the end of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev, who introduced more freedom of the press, and some of the reason for this was purely practical. He no longer knew what was happening in different parts of the country, and so it was impossible to govern. So let's us go back, right back in Britain, to the 16th century. And, of course, for a long time, all publication was written and copied out by monks. It takes a long time. Most of the population couldn't read in the 13th, 14th century. In fact, in the 13th and 14th century, quite often the king couldn't read. He didn't feel it was necessary. Reading was reserved for the church. And the church needed to read because they needed to read the Bible and interpret it. And so on. And this is why the church, one of the reasons the church was so useful to the king, because they were the only people who could read and write. So if he wanted people to count the population and demand taxes, then often he had to go to the church. But if we move on to the 16th century then, and the Reformation, Henry VIII will introduce state control of printing in 1538. All new books had to be approved by a royal committee, the Privy Council. So this is a period, the Reformation, of course, is a religious change, but it's also a social change. It's a reflection of the rise of new classes who are making their money from commerce and not from land. And so they want more discussion. They want more discussion so they can organise the economy differently. But they also want more discussion because they have a new idea of what religion should be. In the 16th century, if you want a different society and if you want a different religion, that's the same thing. Because religion is politics and politics is religion. It's very difficult for us to see that today. Let's say that in the 16th century, there are no atheists. So everybody believes that God is very interested in what happens in society. And so if I say I want a completely different society, then I will probably say I have a different opinion about what God wants. And this is why the Puritans were the most determined fighters in the Civil War against the king, both for a new view of religion and for a new society. It goes together. Whereas today we're in Western Europe, we tend to think that religion is more a private affair and politics is something else. So the fact that Henry VIII introduces the state control of printing, he doesn't do it just for fun. He obviously does it because there's a problem. You know, you don't pass a law if there's no problem. So there is more criticism around. The Henry VIII, of course, wants a new church of England, but he doesn't read. He's not a Protestant. What he really wants is a Catholic church without the Pope and with the King instead. He doesn't subscribe to all the Protestant ideas about the most important thing is the individual relationship with God and so on. In fact, Henry VIII was quite an educated man, and he wrote books defending traditional theology. I can't remember exactly the name of the book he wrote, but he was known for writing books on theology which were not at all Protestant. But the process of the Reformation carried him along, so he wanted an independent church, and once he got an independent church, the people who were most enthusiastic for the independent church were the people with Protestant ideas. And so he didn't want a Protestant church, but he got one. And when he died and Edward became king, the people around Edward were Protestants, and they made the Church of England, which was originally the Church in England, and then became the Church of England. They made it into a Protestant church. So all this, the introduction of the state control of printing happens at a time when there is already a lot of debate. The Star Chamber is something which I think originally is established by Henry VII, but then perhaps it's Henry VIII, and it's called the Star Chamber. Simply because of the room it was in, la chambre une pièce avec un plafond étoilé. But what is the Star Chamber? Well, the Star Chamber is a special royal court which does not have to follow the other laws, and they can imprison people. It's controlled by the king. They can imprison people and confiscate their lands for reasons which do not have to go through the traditional courts. So it's an element of royal absolutism, relative royal absolutism. And this will continue, 1586, even right up to 1637. 1637, you need some of these dates now. Of course, 1642, the Civil War. Yeah, so that's the central date. So this is just before the Civil War. And of course, if it's just before the Civil War, that means the debate is already happening. It's always a very high level of social tension. The king wants more control, but the new classes want Parliament to have more power so that they can reorganise the economy. Big conflict Parliament-King, which has aspects which are economic, social and, of course, religious, because you can't get away from that. And the Star Chamber, in particular, then judged cases which were said to threaten national security. And the Star Chamber often ignored aspects of common law. So, for example, habeas corpus or not so important. It was a relatively arbitrary form of judicial action. Here you have a picture of this, the Star Chamber. You see it's got stars on the top. And it remains in place until 1641, just before the Civil War. Yeah, the Civil War will abolish it. Because one of the whole points of the Civil War was that parliamentary army wanted to make it impossible for kings to be absolutist. That was the aim of the Civil War. They weren't Republicans, not at the beginning of the Civil War. At the beginning of the Civil War, most of the people in the parliamentary army wanted the king to accept limits to his power. Or the real radicals wanted a different king. And the real radicals, small minority, wanted a republic. Remember, in 1642, the very idea of a republic is pretty strange, or appears pretty strange. And of course, what's notable about the Star Chamber, then, the court sessions are held in secret. No indictments, so you don't have to tell people what they are accused of. No right of appeal, no juries and no witnesses. Okay, so that's there's not much left, is there? There's not much left yet. So an arbitrary form of court, which was one of the forms of censorship in this period. And here is one well-known example. Of course, there were hundreds of people punished by the Star Chamber for doing this and that. But this is one of the more famous examples, John Lilburn. Look him up on Wikipedia. And he was arrested for importing seditious books. So seditious books are books which aim at provoking social tension or social revolution. Huh? Seditious books And so he's fined, flogged, and imprisoned. Flogged, then whipped. And this is not nicely, yeah? It's very, very, very dangerous time to be around. You wouldn't like it. And imprisoned, il y a un end de trop, j'ai honte, il y a des fautes de frappe sur mes trucs. One of the symbolic cases, because Parliament abolished the Star Chamber and had John Lilburn released in 1641. 1641, just before the Civil War, tension, extreme tension between the King and the Parliament. In fact, at one point, the King arrives with soldiers to the Parliament to arrest six of the members of Parliament who have run away, in fact. And after that, the Parliament has armed guards in front of the Parliament to stop the King coming. Now, seeing that the idea of the Parliament traditionally was to advise the King, once you have armed guards in front of the Parliament to stop the King coming, you have the beginning of a civil war. In fact, it will be 6 months before there is a real civil war, but you've already got it in once you have once you have to arm yourself against the people you're supposed to be advising. We're going to move fairly swiftly through this period. So the Civil War, 1642-49, is sometimes called the English Revolution. It's a matter of opinion. Historians do not agree. Not historians cannot agree. That's not their aim. Historians do not agree. Some very important historians like E.P. Thompson and Christopher Hill have underlined the revolutionary nature of the Civil War, where everybody's ideas were completely changed. Whereas other historians have said, well, you're exaggerating. But it has sometimes been called the English Revolution. And one of the things that Karl Marx said about revolutions is the revolution is the festival of the oppressed. That is to say, if we talk about the English Revolution, once the king was executed, everybody, well, I thought the king was there forever. My father was under a king, and my grandfather and my great-grandfather. There's no king. If there's no king, maybe everything else can change as well. And so you have a mass of pamphlets, hundreds and hundreds of political pamphlets being sold in the villages and the market squares. Society has changed. You want to understand it? A large number of women writers writing about the rights of women in 1642, which is a long time before the next wave. A lot of people writing about democracy, which is a dangerous radical idea at this time. Nobody is very small numbers. So a host of radical pamphlets, and fairly quickly Parliament tried to stop Parliament now in power, the King being eliminated, clamping down again, with some success, but not that much. While the Civil War was going on, nobody could really stop people publishing, and people did publish. And during the Civil War, everybody was interested in politics, because you can't be in a Civil War and not be interested in politics, because you live in a town and the King's army is arriving. You can't be neutral. You either said, right, that's great, the King's army's arrived, let's organise to get food for them and help them and recruit some more soldiers. Or you say, no, let's man the walls and fight against them. That suddenly, all the people who said, oh, our politics, I don't care about that, when there's a civil war, there are no neutral people. Well, I say no, I'm exaggerating. But the number of people who are not interested in politics just drops massively, because it's no longer possible. You have to decide. And of course, if people are interested in politics, they need to read. So the Parliament tries to stop the excessive, in their view, publication of new ideas. Very, very radical new ideas, a huge variety. Normally in religious form, we sometimes call them sects. But remember, a sect is other people's religion. Yeah, my religion is a religion, your religion is a sect. It's just a negative word. Some of them rather wild. The ranters, for example. The ranters are my favourite sect. They weren't very big, but they believed that the way to liberate yourself from sin is to indulge in as much sin as possible. They said, what you need to do is you need to drink a lot and have a lot of sex and swear and blaspheme, and this is the way to God. It's a nice idea as a religion, I think. But that, it's just the sort of punk rock of the English Revolution. One famous and important contribution to this debate at this time on the freedom of publication is John Milton, great English poet who wrote Paradise Lost. That's what he's famous for. And really, if you like poetry, it's pretty good stuff. And he wrote this book, Areopagitica. I haven't had the time to look up the meaning of the meaning of the title. Anybody know the meaning of Areopagitica? Nope, me neither. It looks like it could be the war of publication, but I'm not sure. It'll be Latin yet, or isn't. Anyway, in any case, John Milton wrote this book in order to say Parliament and the King should not limit publication. Everybody should have the freedom to publish what they like. At this time, this is an extreme minority view. It's very very unusual. It's very very pioneering. And of course, and this is John Milton as well. He writes extremely well. Yeah, this is really something. I have an extract from it somewhere. I'll try to put it up on the blog. There you go. It's a speech of Mr. John Milton for the liberty of unlicensed printing. Yeah, unlicensed, that it's no longer necessary. It should not be necessary, in the opinion of John Milton, to ask for a license. It should just be anybody can print what they like. And despite the ridiculous clothes, this is John Milton, a civil servant for the Commonwealth of England. The Commonwealth then from 1649 to 1660, the form of government when there was not a monarchy in Britain. And you have three different words you can choose for this period. The conservative monarchists say it's the interregnum, entre deux rois. The radicals say it's the English Republic. But the word they used at the time was the Commonwealth of England. I hope I'm not repeating what I said last week, because I always forget what I say as soon as I do. Now, after the Restoration, now this is, these are dates which you are beginning to have automatic. 1660, the Restoration. We have a king again. Yeah, this needs to be absolutely automatic, yeah, the big dates. We have a king again. What happens? The elites ask the king to come back. They asked the son of the king who'd been executed to come back and be king again. On condition that, and that's a very important thing, on condition that. Now, James, who was in France, he wanted to come back and be king. It was the only job he knew how to do. And so he encouraged them to invite him by writing an amnesty. Yeah, an amnesty for people who had fought in the Civil War. Without the amnesty, it was not possible. Nothing. We could not have got it back. And so they got an agreement between Parliament and James. James became king again. That's called the Restoration. We also use it as a word for styles of architecture, restoration furniture. So it marked a particular style. So James came back and we had a king again, but with much less power. This was the deal. It was kind of a... and from then on, Parliament was boss. I already mentioned this last week. After the Restoration, there was the Licensing Act of 1662, so it was still considered to be pretty normal to control publishing, to limit the freedom of the press. To such an extent that in 1664, one example, many examples, the printer John Twin is executed for publishing material suggesting that the monarch was accounting to his subjects. Okay, so this is just to give you an idea. Yeah, you get executed if you say, oh, well, the king should listen to his subjects. Oh, the king is not the real boss. You get executed for that. And, of course, when you're executed at the time, you are hung, drawn, and quartered. First of all, you're hung, slowly. Then you're cut into quarters, and the quarters are sent to the four corners of England. The tradition. Of course, the idea, yeah, of course you're dead after the first bit, but the idea is to make sure as many people as possible see a quarter of you and thinks, maybe I won't publish any books this year. You know, it's very convincing, yeah? It's very physical, because of course they're not going, most people are not going to read, but if they see a quarter of you, that's pretty impressive. You say, oh my God, yeah, he looks in a bad way. Okay, so executed. After the glorious revolution of 1688, the Licensing Act was allowed to lapse. So, interesting thing there. Notice the glorious revolution. Do you remember what the Glorious Revolution is? I'm sure I mentioned it. Somebody give me a Glorious Revolution. One sentence of the Glorious Revolution, somebody. Yeah? Okay, the Glorious Revolution 1688 is when the Parliament decides they don't like the king, so they choose another one. Notice the quotation marks. It wasn't glorious, it wasn't a revolution. You know, it's called the Glorious Revolution. And it is a moment when the Parliament is unhappy with the king, and so they simply choose another one. In Holland, William of Orange, they write him a letter, "Oh, if you come with your army, you'll find a lot of support." And he did find a lot of support. The Parliament allowed the reigning king, James II, I think, to flee to France. And so it's very symbolic, because it showed that it was the Parliament who chose the king from now on. Now, they never had to do it again. After that, all the kings behaved themselves. Yeah, but that was very, very big and symbolic. The reason that they wanted to get rid of the king was that he was a Catholic. Of course, that was a big problem for them. But in any case, in this period, you have the establishment of the Bill of Rights. And also, the Licensing Act just is not renewed and is allowed to lapse. So you have a period with a little bit more freedom. There is a rise of different newspapers, and in particular provincial newspapers. Now, newspapers in Britain, even today, are rather particular, and the first thing that's particular about them is that they're extremely popular. It's very habitual in Britain to read two newspapers a day, a national daily in the morning and a regional daily in the evening. That's what my mother does. Yeah. Okay. How many people read two newspapers yesterday? It's not very French, is it, to read two newspapers a day, even one? So, of course, the situation is changing with the internet, but even today, the newspapers are very, very widely sold in Britain. There are several newspapers in Britain that sell more than 1 million. In France, if you have a news every day, in France, you can't sell 1 million newspapers a day. Nobody can do it. It can't be done. Je crois que West France y arrive tout juste. It's just a different one. The other country where they read a lot of newspapers is Japan. Why not? However, the fight for a free press was not over yet. So it continues to be a struggle. And one of the figures of this struggle is John Wilkes, 1763. Member of Parliament and newspaper editor, John Wilkes, is imprisoned in the Tower of London. Ça quand même du classe, hein? On se fait emprisonner, autant être dans la Tour de Londres. Because he criticised the king and the prime minister. Okay, he became what we call in English a cause célèbre, en français dans le texte, a cause célèbre. And you had a mass political campaign to defend Wilkes. And the slogan was, "For Wilkes and Liberty." And a very interesting campaign, because it's in the 18th century, there are more and more people in the towns, slowly and so on. The Wilkes campaign used a lot of newish methods. For example, they had pottery, des assiettes et des tasses, with the slogan on, "For Wilkes and Liberty." And they sold hundreds and thousands of these. This was the symbol. Instead of a badge, you might have a badge today, there was the similar pottery. You can see it in the museums, very beautiful pottery. Of course, mostly a middle-class movement, because the ordinary agricultural labourers didn't really have pretty pottery at home, or didn't have pottery at all sometimes. But this was a symbol. Popular campaign to defend John Wilkes and the freedom of the press. Here we have a picture of John Wilkes writing at his desk. Okay, it's not a photograph. In 1786. And his newspaper, The North Briton. Now, in 1760, that's an example from 1763. This is very early for radical newspapers. Yeah, you can to have a radical newspaper, you need one, a lot of people who can read, and two, good transport in the country. Yeah. Those are two things. And before that, you can't have good newspapers. So newspapers are rising. The Times is established, I think, in 1770, something like that. It's an old newspaper, The Times, 1770, I'm pretty sure, which is pretty old. And The Guardian is in the early 19th century. even today's newspapers have a long history in Britain. So there he is. And the importance, this is just in passing, underlines the importance of newspapers for all the radical movements. Newspapers have always been important in Britain for all the radical news movements. Even today, if you go to Britain and you go to a supermarket on a Saturday, you might well see somebody in front of the supermarket saying, "Get your copy of Socialist Worker or Militant," and the different left newspapers which are sold à la criée. Also, the regional, that's for the political movements, but also the regional newspapers are sold, je sais pas comment dire en anglais, à la criée. And if you go to Leeds, for example, in the South Centre, you'll hear, Evening Post. In Blackpool, you have Nangazer, Evening Gazette. It's a tradition to sell the regional newspapers by shouting out. You occasionally see this in France, but it's not really a French tradition. It's very much an English tradition. So, John Wilkes went on for two. His fight for the freedom of the press went on for two elephants. I don't know what, two decades maybe? Yes, two decades, I think. Yeah, 20 years. However, he had to leave the country for 4 years. He went to France. Of course, it was a good time to go to France. The revolution was coming along. He was fined and sentenced to prison for libel, but he was also re-elected three times as Member of Parliament. So obviously there's a big debate, a big division. Some people saying, yes, let's vote for John Wilkes. That's the sort of Member of Parliament we want. And other people say, no, he unreasonably criticises the system and puts the social stability into danger. So he was re-elected three times and expelled three times from Parliament. Quite a figure. But he did continue with his main objective. This is what he said: the liberty of the press is the birthright of a Briton. He was mostly talking about the middle classes. I mean, at this time, they wouldn't think that... Well, the peasants couldn't read, and the workers couldn't really read very much. So that wasn't the problem, but it was this important idea. And he became Lord Mayor of the City of London in 1774 and continued to support, as Lord Mayor, continued to support the idea of free publication. In particular, one of the conflicts came up over parliamentary debates. It had been established that inside the Parliament, members of Parliament had the right to criticise the government. A sort of immunité parlementaire. Inside the Parliament, the members of Parliament had the right to criticise the government. However, did people have the right to print what was said in Parliament? This was a big debate, and Wilkes was on one particular side, trying to make sure that the parliamentary debates could be read by the people of London and other cities. The reason that, although the king and his ministers hated John Wilkes, he was so popular that they didn't dare keep him in prison for very long. He won out eventually. One of the on this particular question of printing parliamentary debates, Wilkes and his friends won. And one of his friends, John Allman, began the Parliamentary Register, which was the forerunner of Hansard Today, the newspaper which publishes every day everything that was said in Parliament. Is called Hansard. And you can get it free on the web these days. You can have Hansard. It can be very interesting if you're someday involved in research, because if you want to know what happened to this law in 1933, you can find exactly the entire debate in Hansard. Hansard is a... Historians are very happy that he won. Yeah, because we have, from 1774, we have everything that was said in Parliament. Now, a lot of it's very boring, yeah? But still, it's good for historians. A victory for the press and for freedom of access to public information. Of course, there are kinds of information which are not available for the public. Military information... and other internal information. Let's have a look over at theatres. Let's leave the press for a while and move over to theatres. Theatres, very important places, especially before the 20th century. Because, of course, in a situation where, firstly, of course, there's no cinema, television, and radio, but secondly, many people cannot read, the theatres were important places, and satirical or political theatre had a certain influence. When the Civil War began, the most influential people on the parliamentary side were Puritans. That is to say, they were people who were rebelling against what they saw as the corruption of the traditional church. And part of their idea was, we need to lead a very simple life which is close to God. In the opinions of many Puritans, that meant no theatre, no music in the churches, etc. And so the theatres were actually closed down in 1642 by the parliaments under the influence of the Puritans. So Puritans, interesting people. On the one hand, they have this very traditionalist view of, you know, no music, no theatre, which is a bit depressing. On the other hand, they stand for destroying the strict hierarchy and corruption of the old church. So they're, you know, they're somewhere, it's difficult to categorise them directly. And the Puritans are the closest people to democracy at this time. There you have the Globe being closed down. The Globe, of course, Shakespeare's theatre, a reproduction of it now exists in London. They have reproduced Shakespeare's old theatre and they play Shakespeare plays there. This year there was something, just a parenthesis, this year there was something very exciting in London because as part of the Olympic Games they had a big cultural festival and one of the things they decided to do was to produce all of Shakespeare's plays, each one in a different language. And so they got, you know, they got the best theatre group from Kazakhstan to do Hamlet in Kazakh, and then they had the, you know, Macbeth in Basque, and every day was a different language and a different play. And they were some of the best theatre groups in the world from places you don't normally go. Very interesting, so it was a kind of multiculturalist view of Shakespeare. You know, it's a very interesting sort of thing to do with Shakespeare. But let's go back to the 17th century. The theatres are closed by the Puritans in 1642, reopened with the Restoration, and in the Restoration we have for the first time the possibility for women to perform on the theatre. Previously, this remained very non-respectable. Even at the beginning of the 20th century, if you were a middle-class family, you did not want your daughter to become an actress because it was kind of showing your emotions and your movements in public. You were almost a prostitute in people's minds. That was the idea. In fact, very frequently, when people made joke about actresses, everybody understood something else for actresses. So, the women were allowed to perform for the first time. Of course, this reflects, of course, you remember that when Shakespeare produced his plays, they had to have young boys to play the women, because it wasn't possible. Censorship remained in 1660, controlled by the king through a rather strange character, whose name was the Master of the Revels. Yeah, literally, le maître des réjouissances. Okay? And the first Prime Minister, Walpole, the Prime Minister develops at this time. The Parliament has more autonomy and the Prime Minister... Also, the parliamentary life gets much more complicated. The more society advances, the more laws you need. In the 14th century, where things didn't change very much, you didn't need a lot of laws, and it becomes more and more complex. And Walpole is a target for the playwrights. Lots of satires of Walpole, sometimes extremely rude. Also drawings in the newspapers, some of them are very pee-pee caca. Really, things that today you would be very surprised to see. Yeah? I think it's important that we sometimes have the impression that a long time ago people were polite all the time. It's absolutely untrue. And with other things as well, we consider today sometimes that we live in a violent society. This I consider a joke. 100 years ago, it was much more violent. It's just not the same standards at all. Walpole reacted in part by a new licensing act in 1737, which imposed a strict censorship on the theatre. There you have a picture of Walpole. And we can, just to jump forward a whole century, in the Theatre Act 1838, the Lord Chamberlain was given more power to control the theatre, and the Lord Chamberlain remained the person who censored the theatre until 1968. Yeah? Censorship of the theatre was organised by the Lord Chamberlain until 1968. If you want to watch a good film, a film about the Second World War, Mrs. Henderson Presents, c'est le titre, Mrs. Henderson Presents, and it's about a theatre in London during the Second World War, they wanted to show shows a little along the lines of the Folies Bergères, approximately, but they had tremendous problems because the Lord Chamberlain said, oh no, you absolutely cannot do that, I am the censor and you can't do it. And it's the story of how she persuaded him to allow something which was not quite like Paris, but which was along those lines. Very, very interesting story about sex and war, which is a good subject, sex and war, yes. Okay, I think one is better than the other. Right. So the Lord Chamberlain for more than 100 years, 150 years or more, has power over the theatres and can refuse them. Now, very often it will be informal. That is to say, a play is produced and the Lord Chamberlain will see a section which he considers obscene or blasphemous or against national interest, and he will have a quick word to the theatre director, who will immediately change the play. It's not necessary. In the 19th century, the 20th century, it's not necessary to throw people in prison. It's a kind of imposed self-discipline. Just one example here, just before World War I, a music hall sketch, which was thought of as insulting to an ally of the monarch, was rapidly modified after an intervention by the Lord Chamberlain. The Lord Chamberlain also wrote, this is my specialist subject, music hall in the First World War. Yeah, that's what was the subject of my book, my first book, which was published in July. And he wrote a letter to all the music halls in the land, warning them about the dangers of vulgarity. It has to be said that at the time, vulgarity was women showing their ankles. Ankles is good, yeah. Am I right? Yeah, women showing their ankles. This was considered to be really going quite a long way. Blasphemy was if a character on stage said, "Oh my God," that was too much. Yeah. So today we consider it to be, perhaps not so heavy, but at the time this was the level of censorship, which entered into a huge battle about being respectable and not being vulgar. So I've talked a bit about the press in previous centuries and theatre in previous centuries. I just want to look at three famous cases of censorship in the 20th century. These are three that you should know about because, again, you don't need to know 10 cases, but some of them are very, very famous. No doubt the most famous is Lady Chatterley's Lover, Le Monde de Lady Chatterley, by D.H. Lawrence. D.H. Lawrence in general had a lot of... Has anybody read any D.H. Lawrence? Sons and Lovers, yeah? Any more? Okay. I do recommend it. My personal favourite is The Rainbow, Bac au Ciel, which is a tremendous novel. I mean, a lot of fun as well. Tremendous novels. And very advanced in the sense that he managed to put into a novel what Freud had understood about psychology. Freud publishes his books in 1899, 1905, The Interpretation of Dreams, 1905. And Freud very slowly, the ideas get into everybody, or everywhere. And today they are indispensable. D.H. Lawrence puts them into a novel. So I recommend the Rainbow, that Sons and Lovers. Did you like it?
Sons and Lovers. Yeah,
it's pretty powerful stuff, isn't it? And the Ladies' Chatterley's Lover is another one. What's the story? It's about a lady who falls in love with a gardener. It can happen. The reason it was controversial is because some of the scenes are very explicit. It's absolutely not a pornographic book. The explicit scenes are there for a reason, within a story, with psychologies. It's about real people. But it was unacceptable at the time. It was published in 1928 in Italy. Impossible to publish it in Britain. Nobody would publish it. Yeah. So they published it in Italy, sold very, very few copies. Certainly D.H. Lawrence was quite a courageous... I mean, he kept on writing novels, nobody bought them, so he wrote another one, so nobody bought them, so he wrote another one. Yeah, and now they are sold in millions every week. Published in Italy in 1928, and after a while it was published in Britain in a censored edition. For a long time, you could buy... Lady Chatterley's Lover, but there were pieces missing. And Penguin Books in 1960 published for the first time the full edition with all the naughty bits in as well. It became a very, very famous trial. So it was published by Penguin Books. So Penguin, very popular. Yeah, Penguin paperbacks, not expensive. Yeah, unexpurgated, ça veut dire pas censuré. It's en français, texte intégral. So they published it in Penguin, that is to say, cheap and for everybody. Yeah, and that was one of the problems. And it became a trial under the Obscene Publications Act, and a trial which was in every newspaper, massive cause célèbre, as they say. The trial of Penguin under the Obscene Publications Act was a major public event and a test of the new obscenity law. Because the new law of 1959 had made it possible for publishers to escape conviction if they could show that a work was of literary merit. So this becomes a bit amusing now, because you have a trial with a judge and a jury trying to decide whether this book is of literary merit. The problem with literary merit is it's very highly subjective, isn't it? You know, some people think it's wonderful, some people think it's awful. But day by day, there's been a great film made of this trial. Day by day, they continued, and they invited various academic experts in literature, including Ian Forster, the novelist, Richard Hoggart, the founder of cultural studies, and one of the first people to say, we need to study what working class people wrote and not just the great literary authors. And Raymond Williams, a Marxist literary theorist, were called as witnesses. It was a very, very strange trial where the witnesses were the most celebrated literary experts in the country, and trying to prove to the jury of ordinary people that this is literature. You know, it was very strange. And the verdict was not guilty. Not guilty. It's not obscene. It's literature. Now, it's just one book, but this was the symbolic book which changed attitudes to a lot of things, and it's also seen as being symbolic the beginning of the 60s. At the beginning of the 60s, you can read D.H. Lawrence talking very honestly about sex. This is the 60s. Yeah, the sexual liberation, entre guillemets, of the 60s. Was out. One of the most amusing parts of it is that the prosecutor, l'accusation, was ridiculed by the press for being out of touch with changing social norms, because in particular, the chief prosecutor spoke to the jury and said, "Is this the kind of book you would wish your wife or your servants to read?" So for him, of course, everybody has servants. He was an aristocrat. He didn't understand the jury were ordinary people, but he was so old-fashioned that, first of all, he considered that he was only talking to men. Yeah. He was only talking to men. "Do you want your wives to read this?" That is to say, "I'm not talking to the women. Women don't have important opinions." And secondly, "Would you like your servants to read this?" Even in 1960... the vast majority, 85% of the British, did not have servants. So he was really just a very old-fashioned elitist, and he probably regretted the phrase because it was in every newspaper the next day. So one of the most famous censorship trials, Lady Chatterley's lover, 1960, the result, a symbolic beginning of the 1960s, a symbolic end to very old-fashioned censorship. Not the only example at all, but a big, important symbol. I have a second example here, not so famous. In fact, it all happens before, but it's published at the same time, 1928, the same as Lady Chatterley's Lover. Not so famous. Actually, to be frank, not so good a book. It's not a great novel. It's a symbolic novel because it made a difference, but it's not a great novel like P.H. Lawrence. The Well of Loneliness is a 1928 novel by the British author Radcliffe Hall, by a woman. It follows the life of Stephen Gordon, so a woman with a man's name, Stephen Gordon, an English woman from an upper-class family whose sexual inversion, this was the word they used at the time for homosexuality, is apparent from an early age. She finds love with Mary Llewellyn, who she meets while serving as an ambulance driver in World War I. But their happiness together is marred by social isolation and rejection, which the author depicts as having a debilitating effect on inverts, homosexuals. The novel portrays inversion as a natural, God-given state and makes it explicitly give us also the right to our existence. So it's not the first novel about lesbians, but it's the first famous one. And the problem was, Radcliffe Hall was already famous. She had written other novels about other questions. And so when it came out in the bookshops, for the first 2 or 3 weeks there was no problem. It was in all the bookshops. And then a journalist from a conservative newspaper decided to run a campaign against it. Now, this is very different from Lady Chatterley's Lover. There is no sex in the book at all. There are no sex scenes at all. In fact, I think we have the example here. Yes, the novel became the target of a campaign by James Douglas, the editor. Attention, editor. Comment on dit editor en français? Comment on dit editor en français? C'est dit l'inverse, oui. C'est qui the editor? Vous imaginez bien que ce n'est pas l'éditeur, sinon je n'aurais pas posé la question. Hein. oui, voilà. Donc déjà, vous avez trouvé le premier. C'est le rédacteur en chef. The editor, c'est le rédacteur en chef. That's an important difference, yes. It's not the pub. You're quite right, however. L'éditeur is the publisher. Yeah, it's the opposite question. Also important. These are important mistakes to avoid. Yeah, they won't like that. So the editor of the Sunday Express, so an important person, the Sunday Express, a very conservative newspaper. He launched a big campaign for the book to be banned, and famously he said, "I would rather give a healthy boy or a healthy girl a phial of prussic acid to kill them than this novel." It's quite heavy thing. So I would rather kill my child rather than have them read this novel. Okay, fine, good. I'm just leaving now. This is interesting because very, 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 very strong feelings. Very strong feelings. And this was generalised. This is perhaps not so. Strong feelings are not that rare in politics. Today in Britain, the majority of the population thinks that gay people should get married. But only 30 years ago, in the 70s, nobody supported homosexuals, and many people detested homosexuals. They didn't know any, they just detested them. Yeah. It reminds me, perhaps, if you remember the south of the United States in the 1960s, when you had the first black children in the white schools, and the very first, I've got a recording, an interview with the first black girl to go to a white school, and she had to have the army there to protect her. And very, very extremely rigid attitudes, yeah? I mean, of course, we all know people who are racist, but that kind of absolutely deep and rigid racism, it belongs to particular periods. And that's the kind of attitude you've got here, really, the very, very hard. Although its only sexual reference consists of the words, and that night they were not divided. Donc vous voyez que c'est pas franchement de la pornographie. Yeah, okay. Nevertheless, a British court judged it obscene because it defended unnatural practices between women. So it disappeared. In the United States, the book survived legal challenges in New York State and in customs courts. It never became... people read it today, but only because it was banned. It's not that wonderful. It's an ordinary story. You know, it's not D.H. Lawrence. It just doesn't. Okay, so a second important symbolic banning, which shows us something. One more, and it's all over. Of course, there are many more cases. I wanted to give you three, so you had some idea of the big ones. 1976. So this is much later. It's after 1968. We often talk about the... sexual liberation of the 1960s, which I think was very relative. Yeah. Certainly not as big as everybody said. But this is after this. 1976, Mary Whitehouse, important person, Mary Whitehouse, a conservative lady, a big campaigner against pornography, a big campaigner against vulgarity of all sorts. She brought a private prosecution, yes? So you see, the government was not interested. The government did not want to prosecute. So Mary Whitehouse brought a private prosecution against the newspaper and its editor over the publication of a poem, The Love That Dares to Speak Its Name. So Gay News, of course, a homosexual newspaper, at the time the only one, very cheap. The bookshops will not sell it. The newspaper sellers will not sell it. It's sold individual hand to hand. Publishing a lot of information for gay people in a difficult time, but also publishing this poem, which was not very subtle. It's about how wonderful it was to make love to Jesus. Okay, so you can imagine that some people were unhappy with this poem. I mean, it is the sort of poem that you may read if you wish, but I would be too embarrassed to show it to you in class. It's pretty direct. Okay, but they were accused of blasphemy. Interesting. So not accused of obscenity, but accused of blasphemy, because remember, in Britain, the Church of England is the official church of the country, and so it's a specific situation, and they were found guilty in July 1977 and sentenced to a suspended 9-month prison sentence. What does that mean, a suspended sentence in French? Exactly, la prison avec sursis, yes, a suspended sentence. Ça ne veut pas dire que vous êtes pendu pendant 9 mois. Okay, suspended sentence. And when all totaled up, it cost a lot of money. After several appeals, the suspended prison sentence was dropped, but the conviction remained in force. So that was the case that there were things you could not do in the 1970s. Famous cases. Those are really the only famous cases in the 20th century, but there are some other things that is... I've got another one. In the 1960s... Well, that's because... let's go back to the theatres, because I mentioned to you that the Theatres Act of 1968 abolishes the role of the Lord Chamberlain, but in the 1960s before, it was not an abstract... situation. The Lord Chamberlain really did ban a lot of plays. And one of the examples is A Patriot for Me, a 1965 play by the English playwright John Osborne. So one of the top British playwrights, not some little playwright, it was denied a license for performance. They were obliged to produce this play in a private club. The play is about Redl, a Jewish homosexual in the Austro-Hungarian intelligence service in the 1890s, as he's blackmailed by the Russians into a series of treasonous betrayals. Its dramatic climax and the scene that most excited the censor is the drag ball, donc le bal des travestis, in which members of the upper echelons of Viennese society appear in drag. Mary McCarthy, the American novelist, wrote to the Observer that the play's chief merit is to provide work for a number of homosexual actors or normal actors who can pass as homosexuals. Okay, it's just an example of a play by a famous playwright, which was censored by the Lord Chamberlain. But 1968, it is decided that, so this is the Labour governments, again, the major governments of the 20th century, you need to have them automatically. Labour government 1964 to 1970, Harold Wilson. And one of the, there was a series of liberal social reforms, the decriminalisation of homosexuality, the legalisation of abortion, and the abolition of theatre censorship, which were brought in here. Some of them very interesting, because the decriminalisation of homosexuality and the legalisation of abortion were not mentioned in the manifesto in 1964. The Labour Party thought, oh, we might do that, but shh. Perhaps public opinion isn't ready. Also, the abolition of capital punishment, same thing. So the interesting thing, the Labour government would introduce these social reforms but weren't convinced that the public was really behind them. Which is partly true because, strangely enough, public opinion changed after the law changed. The law changed first and then public opinion changed. This is not that unusual. Yeah? When in France, when they abolished capital punishment in 1981, after the law changed, the popularity of the idea of capital punishment went down. So what does this mean? I don't know. You have to ask a social psychologist or somebody who knows things like that. But it's certainly not unusual to see that the law changes first and attitudes change afterwards. So, no more censorship in the theatre, but we will still see some censorship in the press. And I want to look now at radio and television and a couple of examples of questions of censorship and freedom in radio and television. And one of the practical examples, very big example, 1988. Conservative government, Margaret Thatcher. Very worried about the situation in Ireland. It seems to be impossible to defeat the IRA militarily. So they try many things, but one of the things that the government does is they decide it is now illegal to interview on radio or television any member of an organisation which supports terrorism. Now, this did not apply to members of the IRA. The IRA was an illegal organisation, so was never interviewed. But there's a political, the Irish Nationalist Political Party, Sinn Féin, which was a legal organisation with members of parliament, was banned from radio and television. So it was illegal to interview a member of Sinn Féin. Even if the member of Sinn Féin was giving their opinion on hospitals or women's rights, it was illegal because they were part of an organisation which the government considered supported terrorism. So, in 1988, the Conservative government instituted a ban on interviewing on radio or television members of organisations which support terrorism. The main target was Sinn Féin, a legal organisation, an Irish nationalist organisation, which had links with an illegal organisation, the Irish Republican Army. Even statements made of the organisation on other issues, made by the organisation on other issues with no connection to the IRA, were banned. The ban was partly effective in that many radios and televisions simply, pass it for me, but simply, I was working too late last night, omitted Sinn Féin's point of view. You've got to remember how radio and television works. Say, okay, something's happened. We need information. We've got to do 17 minutes on this. So interview somebody. Oh, we can't interview Sinn Féin. Forget it. Interview somebody else. You know, so they just omit it. However, the BBC were not happy. And the journalists were not happy because, in general, journalists like to be free. And so what the BBC did is they hired other people, they hired actors to play the role. And so they said on the BBC, they said, yesterday we interviewed Gerry Adams from Sinn Féin. Here is an actor saying what he said. Yeah. So they are avoiding the law. It's legal. And this is where it became a problem for the government, because this included the BBC World Service, probably the most respected radio station in the world. And the entire world knew that the British government banned people saying things which actually sounded quite reasonable often. Yeah. And so the problem, if you're a government, which I'm not, but if you're a government and you ban things, it can be useful, but it can be dangerous. And it turned out that eventually the British government appeared to be not very democratic. There were other examples as well. Sometimes in some of the newspapers, the journalists wrote, "We interviewed a member of Sinn Féin, but the government has the government says it is illegal to print it. This is why this page is blank," and they left the page blank. Okay, which of course is political symbol. Yeah, it looks, you know, Britain is supposed to be this great democracy, so it was not so great for the government. And in 1994, the Conservative government will abandon the idea. Yeah, it was a pretty bad idea, I think. Even from the point of view of the Conservative government, it was not such a good idea. But an interesting idea. Here is Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin at the time, who was later member of Parliament for West Belfast from 1997 to 2011. And one of the Irish politicians who was generally considered a terrorist before he was generally considered as a democratic leader. So like Nelson Mandela, who was generally considered to be a terrorist until about 84. So it's a matter of labels. Yeah, labels are difficult. So let's come back to the situation today, just the legal situation today about radio and television. Radio and television broadcasting is supervised by two bodies, the British Broadcasting Corporation for Public Television and Radio. That is to say that the BBC is its own control. There is a section of the BBC whose job it is to check everything, to make sure that nothing illegal, for example, racist or racist things do go out on the BBC, but not too racist or inciting criminal or inciting to violence and so on. And for the private TV and radio, there is Ofcom. Now, television and radio are interesting phenomena. In general, in Western Europe, we consider that it's normal to have state radio. The BBC, the leaders of the BBC, the governors, are appointed by the government. I think that's the same in France with France 2 and France 3. And most democratic countries in Europe think, yeah, you should have radio and television controlled by the governments. However, newspapers, we generally think it's not democratic to have newspapers controlled by the government. I don't exactly understand why television and not newspapers, but that's the general situation today. So here are the people who are meant to be checking what's going out. So Ofcom, who deal with private television, they have a statutory duty to further the interests of citizens and consumers. How? By promoting competition, this is part of the neoliberal approach, and protecting consumers from harmful or offensive material. So, for example, yeah, films which concentrate on sex are not shown on television before, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night or something like that. Some of the main areas over which Ofcom presides are licensing, creating codes and policies, addressing complaints and looking into competition. These are some of the things. So Ofcom, a government-appointed body to check on private broadcasting. The government has quite a lot of power because although, of course, the government doesn't usually use official censorship, they do have quite a lot of power. First of all, the government chooses the governors of the BBC. Les administrateurs de la BBC sont choisis par le gouvernement. And so they can, if they wish, fill it with government supporters. If it's a Conservative government, they can appoint Conservative people. And if it's a Labour government, they can appoint Labour people. Sometimes they are a little careful. They don't want to appear too undemocratic. Nevertheless, there are more of their own that get in there. And certainly Margaret Thatcher and John Major did a lot of that. They also have, governments have some power over the Independent Television Corporation. because if a private television company is not presenting the political view that the government wants, they can put pressure and refuse to renew a franchise. For example, in Yorkshire, Yorkshire Television has the franchise for the regional television. It lasts for, 5 years. And after 5 years, they must apply to renew it. And if the ITC says no, they have no right to do the television anymore. So there is a possibility for putting pressure on there. This is, entre parenthèses, just a little example from newspapers. Something particular about newspapers in Britain is that on the day of the election, all newspapers tell you on the front page who you should vote for. Now, in France, this is not possible. I mean, we know that Le Figaro does not want us to vote communist, but they don't say on the front page, votez for so-and-so. It's not a tradition in France. Whereas in Britain, on the day of the election, every newspaper says, vote Conservative or vote Labour. And sometimes they can have quite a lot of influence because The Sun, for example, sells 3 million copies every day. 3 million copies every day. And so in 1997, when The Sun, which had always been a conservative newspaper, decided to support Tony Blair, the Labour Party, this was an important event for the Labour Party. Because of course, 3 million people buy The Sun. That doesn't mean that they follow everything in it. But nevertheless, it has some influence. And 20 years later, The Sun decided not to support Labour anymore. And so this is just to show you something about political influence in the press. To go over to public television, the BBC, the terms of the BBC's Royal Charter and the laws, the Television and Broadcasting Act, place a requirement on the BBC and Ofcom to maintain political impartiality. This is in contrast to the press, where there is no such requirement. If you publish a newspaper in Britain, you can be completely in favour of the Conservatives or completely in favour of the Labour or the Communists, if you can find them. It's not illegal. But the television, no. The television is obliged to be impartial. Now, being impartial is probably impossible, but certainly they are obliged to give space to the two big parties. And the 1990 Broadcasting Act made this requirement stronger by imposing a new code of impartiality. However, this is difficult because, of course, if you have a minority opinion, that doesn't mean your opinion will be presented. There is a notion of due impartiality, that is to say, not absolute impartiality, but reasonable impartiality. And this means that there can only be objectivity and impartiality within the boundaries of what is generally agreed and acceptable in society. That is to say, what is consensual. So, for example, television broadcasters are obliged to call members of the IRA terrorists, and they may not call them freedom fighters. That is because the people who think of the IRA as freedom fighters are a small minority in Britain. Not in Ireland, but in Britain. And so there's this idea that within the limits of consensus. So that can sometimes be problematic. Sometimes documentaries about Ireland have disappeared before the BBC presented them. Ça, je veux pas vous dire parce que c'est trop détaillé. I'm just going to finish the section and move on to another question in a moment. I just want to finish this section on the freedom of information. By another reform introduced by Tony Blair. Now, we remember, if we look at the Labour governments, we remember the 1945-50 Labour government by massive social reforms. Millions of houses, free hospitals, free doctors, expansion in education. The second big Labour government, 1964-70, smaller social reforms. But nevertheless, lots of new universities, the Open University, and a lot of reforms of a social nature like abortion, homosexuality, which are not so expensive. It's not as expensive as building millions of new houses, but it's on a social thing. And the third big period, 1997 to 2007, Tony Blair and then Gordon Brown, this is right in the crisis, so they don't want to find, or they feel they cannot find money for expensive reforms, but they introduce a series of important democratic reforms. I mentioned the reforming of the House of Lords and the abolition of the hereditary principle in the House of Lords, which is pretty big. Minimum wage. And here is a third one, the Freedom of Information Act. On the model of the American equivalent, about which I know nothing, the Freedom of Information Act was passed by Tony Blair in 2000 and gives a general right of access to the public or to journalists to documents produced by public bodies. This is a big change. This means that, supposing you know, because somebody told you, that the local hospital had a meeting about intensive care and when should we save people and when should we let people die. A secret meeting, of course, a clandestine meeting. All hospitals must have this meeting. But with the Freedom of Information Act, you can go to the hospitals and say, I want the details of what was said in this meeting, and the hospital is obliged to give it to you. All public documents are open if you ask for them. So you can imagine that in many situations, that was just an example I invented about the hospital, but it could really happen. So the same thing, this is particularly, it's often used when there is suspicion of corruption. But also in many political situations, it can be politically very interesting to get the real documents. Every year, journalists make 12,000 requests for information. And the public body or the government must give a very good reason to refuse. Normally they don't refuse. There have been a number of important scandals in this way. It's a sort of legal version of WikiLeaks. Information released has caused some scandals, in particular about MPs' expenses. Little vocabulary test. What are expenses? No, that's expenditure. Nope. What are expenses? C'est only frais professionnels. Donc c'est les notes de frais. So the scandals about MPs' expenses are about the money that the members of parliament ask for from the government for professional expenses. Of course, members of parliament have professional expenses. If they are obliged to go to France in an aeroplane, then it's for business, and so they get the money back, which is acceptable. However, when the journalist asked for the documents, les notes de frais, the documents of each member of parliament, they found some very impressive things. Comment on appelle quand on a un vieux château et il y a de l'eau tout autour? La douve? Pardon? Une douve, yeah. Alors, les frais de réparation de la douve, comme frais professionnel d'un député, j'ai pas inventé. That was a real example. Repairing the moat, cleaning the moat. So, let's say that some of the members of parliament were shown to be spending a lot of money and pretending that it was for their job. Another example which got on the front page of every newspaper was renting pornographic videos for your husband.
Well, ce n'est pas le plus important ni le plus cher, mais bon, c'était celui que tous les journalistes voulaient mettre en première page, bien sûr. C'était une pauvre députée écolo.
Terrible. So there were some very, very important things. The other classic thing was,
vous aviez droit, si vous étiez obligé d'avoir une résidence secondaire à cause de votre mandat.
And what they do is they would have a very small flat and a very big house.
Et ils déclaraient la grande maison comme résidence secondaire et tous les frais comme frais professionnels.
So just general corruption. It was a big scandal. There was a lot of very shocking details, and this was brought out because of the Freedom of Information Act. And the second example was that in the 1960s, when Israel was developing a nuclear bomb, the British government gave secret support for this, and nobody knew until 5 years ago. A journalist said, "I want the details of this meeting on this particular day in 1963. And again, big scandal. Now, the government is allowed to refuse. They normally don't refuse, because if you refuse, it's a scandal as well, you know. And the only example when they did refuse and use their veto was to withhold cabinet minutes related to the war in Iraq. Minutes, in this case, is a technical meaning. What are the minutes? C'est le procès verbal. Minutes, c'est le procès verbal d'une réunion, pas les minutes d'or. D'ailleurs, on dit parfois en français les minutes d'une réunion. C'est, ou c'est québécois, sinon. Yes, so when there was the decision to go to war in Iraq, the war in Iraq was extremely unpopular in 1993, 1994, and saw the biggest demonstrations in the whole of the 20th century. And the only time the government has used its veto, they didn't want to give the details of the discussion inside the cabinets. Okay, that was the end of the story about press freedom and censorship. I still have 10 minutes, and I'm going to talk to you about religion and religious freedom, because, of course, this has always been considered to be one of the main freedoms. The Civil War, to go back to the Civil War, the 1640s, one of the reasons for the Civil War was that there was not enough freedom for the new religious groups, the new Protestant, the Protestant groups, the Puritan groups, and so on. Sometime later, it took a long time for Catholics and Jews to have equal rights in Britain. These two questions are very different. Catholics' rights were limited for a long time for political reasons. It was considered that Catholics were probably going to be allies of Spain and France against Britain's interests. So in the 17th and 18th century, like, you know, when Britain was fighting Napoleon, for example, at the beginning of the 19th century, many people considered, well, if you're Catholic, you're probably in favor of France against Britain. That is to say, Protestantism was part of the British national identity. The Catholics were only 10%, and the lack of freedom for Catholics was partly based on the Protestant idea that Catholics are backward, uncivilized barbarians. I allow myself to say this because I'm a Catholic, and my mother is an uncivilized barbarian. No, she isn't. She's great. Jewish emancipation is quite different, but in some ways it was accidental. That is, that being Christian was considered to, being British was being Christian. So, for example, if you wanted to become a member of Parliament, even in 1850, you had to swear on my good faith as a Christian. And so if you were Jewish, obviously this is problematic. Two solutions. One is you do something else instead of becoming a member of Parliament. But a certain number of Jews said, oh, well, you know, okay, I will swear as a Christian because, you know, that's what you have to do. But very slowly you got the emancipation. Now, small numbers of Jews had been resettling in Britain after 1656. And the first synagogue in London in 1701. However, there was a certain amount of hostility, and the Jewish Naturalisation Act in 1753, which offered British nationality to Jews who had been resident in Britain for 3 years, caused a lot of protest and was immediately repealed. And so there was a lot of prejudice against Jews. This was mostly mostly on the basis of, from a Christian point of view. As you know, they're not Christians. That was the worst thing in the minds of people at the time. The thing about Jews was they're not Christians. Although, also, the Protestant refugees from France were not generally welcomed either. In the 1709 Act, which had been in favour of the Protestant refugees, was also repealed. A lot of German Protestants came to England to escape persecution, but many of them were sent to Ireland or to the colonies, New Zealand, India. And the General Naturalisation Act was repealed in 1712. If we move over to the Catholics, anti-Catholic legislation stayed in force until the end of the 18th century. So there was nothing automatic about freedom for every religion. There was often political elements involved. For example, in 1778, the Papist Act, Papist is a word which means Catholic, but which is often used as an insult, especially in Ireland. Papist is a Catholic. There are many songs about this. I'll try to find you for the blog a famous song about a flute. It's a Protestant song, and it's about a flute which only played Protestant music. And the owner of this flute, a young Protestant, married a Catholic and converted to Catholicism. But when he went to the Catholic Church and began to play the flute, it would only play patriotic Protestant tunes. And so the priest burned the flute. That's the story. It's a kind of funny story about Protestants and Catholics. So the Papist Act was making life easier for Catholics, mostly for rich Catholics. So, for example, the Papist Act 1778 relaxed restrictions on inheritance and schooling. Now, in 1778, inheritance, only the rich inherit, and schools, only the rich go to school. So it's an act to help rich Catholics. The rest of the Catholics don't mind, don't care, because, you know, they'll have that thing. Allowed Catholics to join the army without taking the religious oath. This was passed by the Parliament, but the protest was absolutely massive. And in particular, Lord George Gordon raised a petition against these new laws in favour of Catholics. A huge crowd marched on Parliament in 1780, and the riots continued for a week. Why? Well, part of the popular mentality about Catholics at the time is Catholics are people who support the political system in France, in the Catholic country. And France, of course, in 1780, before the revolution, as an absolutist king, no freedom, no power for parliament. Ils ont été obligés de vous rappeler, ils ont été obligés de le tiers état de s'établir en Assemblée nationale. So, Catholic France was the symbol of traditional absolutist rule with no freedom. And so this is one of them. This is the main reason why crowds of people in London, in particular London, the commercial people in particular, did not want more freedom for Catholics. So it's not, at this moment, it's not directly a question of racism. There you have on the left Lord George Gordon, a picture of him anyway. And on the right, a series of pictures, but I can't actually explain these pictures very well, so let's pretend they're not there. I can't really do the same thing about that. Here you have a painting again of the rioters in London in 1780, the Gordon Riots. They're known as the Gordon Riots because George Gordon was the leader, and they were the biggest anti-Catholic riots based on this idea that Catholicism meant political traditionalism. They're the Gordon Wrights again. You see, they were very important because many people painted them. The army was called, 300 rioters were killed. So it's quite a big event. And, however, there was continued progress in new laws to make life easier for Catholics. 1791, the Catholic Mass was made legal. Catholic worship, il y a la messe, il était légal de faire de la messe. Catholic schools were made legal, and Catholics were allowed to practice law. Most Catholic churches in Britain, Catholics are about 10% of the population. most Catholic churches are from the 19th and 20th century. Because, of course, all the very old churches, 14th century, 15th century, 12th century, the cathedrals, became Church of England at the Reformation. And us English Catholics, we consider that the cathedrals were stolen from us and we should get them back. You see, even today, you know, if we go into a cathedral and say, they stole this one from us in 15... I don't know what, you know. We're still very... This is particularly notable in Dublin, because in Dublin there is a Protestant cathedral, a very old cathedral, which was, of course, Catholic originally, and then at the Reformation became Church of Ireland. And there's another cathedral which is for the Catholics, a 19th century cathedral, but it's not called the cathedral. It's called the pro-cathedral, la cathédrale temporaire, en attendant qu'on récupère l'autre. Ne retenez pas votre espération, c'est pas sûr, sûr, mais... if you're a Catholic, you believe it will happen one day, and the Catholics will come back. They might not. Remember that because in England, the Catholic Church is a minority church, and most Catholics are from Irish or Italian or Polish heritage, and mostly Catholics are working class, very often the Catholic Church in Britain is a little bit on the left of the state, which of course is not the case in France. It has a political, completely different meaning. The priests are normally very close to their parishioners who are workers, so it has a different meaning than it does in France. One last thing about churches before I leave you. In France, it's not unusual to have people who are anticlerical. Not so much your generation, more your grandparents or your parents, and you quite often hear, oh, moi les curés, je déteste ça. It's not so unusual. I have never heard anybody in England say this. Yeah. Anticlericalism doesn't exist, which is interesting. And more of that later. Okay, well, thank you very much. Don't forget your homework.